President Obama chose Richard Blanco to serve as the nation's fifth inaugural poet, marking the first time an immigrant, a Latino, an openly gay American received that honor. Richard Blanco joins me in Studio A to talk about his journey from a Cuban community in Miami to a career as a civil engineer to the development of his voice as a poet. Richard Blanco has written a coming-of-age memoir about growing up in a masculine, conservative culture and having to hide his creative side and his sexuality. Journey of a poet from Cuba to Madrid to Miami to the steps of the Capitol, the inaugural poet Richard Blanco on Midday After the News. Welcome to Midday, our second hour. Thanks for sticking with us. Dan Roderick's here. We have the pleasure of the company this hour of Richard Blanco. We might call him Poet Inaugural or the Poet Inaugurate because many of you will remember him as the poet who read an original work called One Today at President Obama's second inauguration at the Capitol. That was in January 2013. President Obama made some history that day, having selected the youngest inaugural poet, the first immigrant and Latino to have the distinction, and the first openly gay American to recite a poem at a presidential inauguration. I note that only Democrats have chosen poets for their inaugural ceremonies. I looked this up, starting with President Kennedy with Robert Frost in 1961, an event that I can still remember from black and white television. Then President Clinton revived the custom with Maya Angelou in 1993, and also with Miller Williams in 1997. And then President Obama selected Elizabeth Alexander to read her poem, Praise Song for the Day, in 2009 at the first Obama inauguration. And then Richard Blanco took the honors at President Obama's second inaugural. Richard Blanco is our guest. We'll talk with him about that big day in the nation's capital and his journey there. Part of that journey is now told in Richard Blanco's memoir called The Prince of Los Cocoyos, a coming-of-age memoir about growing up in a masculine, conservative culture of Miami and having to hide his creative side and his sexuality. And it's also a very funny book, too. It's a journey of a poet from Cuba to Madrid to Dade County to the steps of the Capitol. Did I have that about right, Richard?
Yeah, with a few cities in between.
Yeah. I guess we should start at the beginning. Anyway, it's nice to have you with us.
Great to be here,
Thanks,
Dan.
Thanks for coming to our studio. Let's see. What did you say about yourself? Assembled in
made in Cuba, assembled in Spain, and imported to the United States.
So go over that for us a little bit.
Well, my mother left 7 months pregnant with me from Cuba, so my I was conceived in Cuba. So my soul is Cuban. And then we emigrated to Spain, to Madrid, because back in the 68, you couldn't emigrate directly to the United States. So we went to Madrid, and then I was born. And 45 days later, after my birth, we emigrated first to New York City and then shortly thereafter to Miami. So by the time I was 45 days old, I belonged to three countries. I had lived in two world-class cities, and my newborn photo, my very first newborn photo, was actually my green card photo. So
wow.
So it was kind of an ironic or foreshadowing of the things that little Ricky would grow up to be obsessed about: home and place and identity and culture and all these things that surround identity. Yeah.
What is your first memory? Do you have a first memory of awareness of life where you were?
Actually, that's a good question. I think I have two. I'm not sure which one came first. One is I remember in New York as a little kid always. My mother would give me my chocolate milk with in this little, remember those bottles that were shaped like bears or whatnot?
Oh, yeah.
Like little animal characters.
Sure.
And she'd put me on the bed as she got ready for work. And I remember always seeing her tease her hair and fix herself up in the dresser mirror while I was drinking my milk. So it must have been, what, like a couple years old?
Right. In
New York City. I went right to daycare because being an immigrant family, I think, I'm not sure exactly what age, but at a very young age, I was already being, not daycare like we think about today. It was some lady who took care of kids in some apartment from some friend of a friend from Cuba, that kind of thing.
Did you Did your family already have relatives in New York? Is that why they emigrated there?
Yeah, there is one of my aunts had lived in Cuba. I'm sorry, in New York before the revolution. This sort of had been established already, and she's mentioned in the memoir. So they helped out the entire family. Eventually, everyone descended into the same apartment building complex where she was the manager for that building. So I had. Say 1, 2, 3 aunts. Then my grandparents met us there in New York. They went through through Mexico, and they helped us a lot. Something that my parents will always be eternally grateful, because they had to send money for us to pay for the visas and the airfare, and they basically financed the whole sort of the whole family coming over to the United States.
You know, one thing I've never understood, maybe you can explain a little bit, is that people were able to get out of Cuba after the revolution. Some Americans listening to this right now might assume that any Cuban that got to Miami, to Florida, did so before Castro took power, but that's actually not true.
No. Yeah. There's been many different waves. The first wave, of course, were the ones that had to get out, that really had to get out, and I think we know why.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah,
and usually they're ones who, you know, because either they had positions in the government or positions of great wealth, and they were targets in some ways. You know, when you have a revolution and if you're on the wrong side of the revolution, you pack your bags, so to speak. But then slowly there's a whole sort of a whole middle class immigration throughout all the rest of the years. And I forget what they were. I think they were called. I don't want to say this wrong, but there was a program set up. I forget the name. It was a petition program. It was illegal. Leaving of the country, but you couldn't come directly to the United States. You had to go to another country and then from there apply to immigration. And then, of course, there's been other waves. So then there was, of course, the Marilito
remember.
Which there's a character in there, Victor, in the memoir
that comes through. He came that way?
Yeah. I mean, Ariel, sorry, who comes that way. Then there was the big rafter crisis, and I can't attach years to that, but... And even now, there's tens of thousands of legal migrations. All my cousins, my first trip to Cuba in 1994, all my cousins that I had met there of my generation all live in Miami now. So there's still a perpetual immigration. And I think it's great because it reinfuses sort of the Cuban culture. And it's really funny to watch because my cousins are sort of going through what my parents went through, but they're my generation. So it's a little weird.
That is a little weird.
And then their children are like the middle generation like me, like I describe in the book, you know, sort of negotiating the two cultures of their old Cuba and the new country, you know, and it's really when it's like this shift in generational.
You call that Cubanidad?
Cubanidad, yeah.
Cubanidad. When did you first hear about all that? You must have been pretty young when your parents started talking about Batista and Castro.
I mean, since I can remember, it was just something in the air, and it was more than just talk. It was a sense of just sort of being lost. I mean, so it was, you know, the immigrant and the exile have very similar experiences, but with the exile, it's this kind of shock because it's kind of like, are we going back? Is something going to change? There's kind of like this limbo sense to their lives. And yet, ironically, you know, they entrench themselves perhaps even more strongly than perhaps some other immigrant groups in Cuba, from Cuba in particular, because Miami, it was this sense of like, we have to make it here, even though we're going back. And it's this weird irony that existed. But yeah, I mean, it was just since I was a kid. And then my mother's entire family, she left her 8 brothers and sisters. She left her every aunt and uncle, every niece and nephew, cousin, no living relatives. She left them all. And so there was always this half a family that I knew nothing about from these old black and white photographs and letters that would come and telegrams and things like that. So you always knew that there was something else on the other side of those 90 miles that was yours and yet not really yours because I'd never been there. And it made it even more mysterious and powerful in that way.
I think you refer to some of those people as ghosts.
Yeah, they were like ghosts. They were like, I mean, they're like these, people like are your cousins and that my mom would try to explain who they were and stories and anecdotes, but it was sort of almost like they were dead, like just ghosts of them because I never really met them. But there was always that, and And then, of course, my parents weren't too politically charged. Some of the other family members were, but oh my God, every time there was usually at Thanksgiving, anytime there was any kind of alcohol involved, they'd get into the whole, like, whose fault was it, the revolution? You know, some right. say Batista, Machado, then they talk about this, they talk about that. It's, you know, still going over what happened, you know, it was sort of like, what did happen, you know, and is anything going to change? Are we going back?
That thing about going back, that's very interesting, the difference between an exile and someone who is an immigrant and, you know, moves to another country with the intention of staying there forever and a better life, right? Yeah. An exile may have some of those same thoughts. But so did you ever feel like your mother, father, other relatives were just not rooted, even though they settled in a community in Miami?
Well, look what they did to Miami. They recreated Cuba. It's also a matter of history, right? So when you think about the immigrant waves of you know, the early part of what century are we in now?
The 21st. So you're thinking
the 20th century. Yeah. And you know, you couldn't hop on a, you know, JetBlue and, like, you know, go back to the homeland for the weekend. I mean, right. you know, when you left Ireland, you left Ireland, you know. And so in that sense, that wasn't even a possibility. But because there is
some got homesick. Got homesick and went back.
Yeah.
But
there is, of course, it is a slightly different, the exile mentality. But then again, given the particular Cuban time when that happened in Cuba, and then you live in Miami, that's, you know, 90 miles from Key West is Cuba. So the proximity of added to that sort of, you know, it's just right there. You know, if something could happen, we could go back. But there's a great irony because in some ways, because they were, you know, sort of thinking about going back, there's this self... Can I explain it? What happens is there's this sense of overly celebrating their own culture or overly protecting those traditions and everything, because in a sense is we're going to take it back exactly how we brought it here. And so there's this weird complex thing about exiles, especially in Miami, where it just was this effort to sort of maintain the culture just as they brought it. So they're not only stuck. And by that I mean love beautifully stuck. It's sort of in the 1950s or 60s. You know, they want to take back exactly what they brought, and they want it to be. And even I, that's the Cuba that I learned from my parents. So when I go to Cuba the first time, you know, there were vestiges of that Cuba of the 1950s and 60s, but I couldn't quite connect with that. That exact Cuba that was my parents' Cuba. It wasn't the same Cuba in the photographs. Similar, but not the same. And so all these sort of interesting layers of thought and psyche that is the community, the Cuban community.
Those strong feelings about Castro or against Castro, right? Do you still hear that today among the younger ones who have managed to get here?
The post-revolutionary...
These cousins you were talking about, yeah.
My cousins, I got to be honest with you, like, I don't... It's such a jaded situation, and they're so jaded in general that they don't even care to talk politics about anything. They they've been... trained not to have an opinion or whatnot, but they don't bring the same because they have nothing. There's no before to the after. See, for them, they grew up in the revolution,
right.
and whether if they liked it or didn't like it is one story. But they have nothing. They didn't lose anything, so to speak. You know, they have no. They're not harboring. I mean, not all of them, of course. I mean, there has been. You know, there are of course Cubans in the revolution that have lost a lot and have. You know, well, we hear stories every once in a while about dissidents and all the rest. But my cousins in particular, you never really have that conversation because it's sort of they have nothing to argue against in the way of something that was before, whereas the older guard has the before and after picture. And then there's a generation like me who's like completely balanced about what, you know, I grew up, you know, my mother grew up in a dirt floor home in Cuba, and then my father was middle class, and there's just this idea of over-glorifying what Cuba was pre-revolutionary. But it had its problems, like every country has had its problems, right? But I grew up with, because of my mother, I think a more balanced view, and, you know, you don't a revolution doesn't happen just because, you know, someone woke up on the wrong side of the bed. But then the other part of it is this over-glorification of the revolution as if, you know, as if it's still into that 19 sort of what I call sort of still sort of looking at Castro through hippie lenses, you know, like that 1960s sort of view of the country and of him as this phenomenon.
Romantic revolutionary.
Yeah. And so we grew up, and I think a follow-up memoir that I want to write to this memoir is my very first trip to Cuba, because I want to offer that balanced view to readers and realize the good and the bad and the ugly on both sides of this. That's always seems to be a polarized event. It's either like Castro is this amazing, wonderful revolutionary or Castro this SOB, you know? Right.
Richard Blanco is our guest. The memoir that he's referring to, his present memoir, is called The Prince of Los Cocuyos, A Miami Childhood. There's a poem after this break I'm going to ask you to read called Looking for the Gulf Motel.
Certainly.
That you, it sort of has a dateline, Marco Island, Florida. So we'll hear Richard Blanco read one of his poems when we get back. This is Midday. Dan Roderick's here. I was going to give the phone number, but that's not necessary. We're just going to talk to Richard here for this hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Richard Blanco with us. This music is the guitar of Manuel Barueco, who is based here in Baltimore. He teaches at the Peabody Conservatory. He's a world-renowned classical guitarist from Cuba. And I thought I knew what year he came. He was born in 1952, but I'm pretty sure Manuel told me that he emigrated here with his parents as a refugee, as a I can't remember what word it was. Maybe it was exile in the 60s sometime.
60s.
Yeah, I think so. Anyway, you should
know. Like sort of like my parents.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Anyways, beautiful music, and that's from an album of his called Cuba. With an tell us about this poem. Were you, Richard?
Sure.
It's called Looking for the Gulf Motel. You don't have to tell us too much, but a little bit about it.
That's Genesis. Basically, as you'll see in the poem, I went back to this place from my childhood that I had great memories from. It's on the west coast of Florida. Wanting to take that proverbial trip down memory lane. And, of course, I hadn't been there in 20-something years, and I thought nothing had changed. And, of course, it did. And I had this sort of horrible response in the sense of that feeling of being erased from the landscape, right? Of like, as if your life had never happened within this landscape. And what was most surprising to me was to realize that I was speaking and responding in the same way that my parents spoke about Cuba and their past. And I realized that sense of loss, that sense of estrangement, that are such a incredible sense, our human need to connect to place, that was really more universal than I even thought, because in some ways I was going through the same thing over this Marco Island, and sort of Marco Island became my Cuba in a way. Looking for the Gulf Motel, Marco Island, Florida. There should be nothing here I don't remember. The Gulf Motel with mermaid lampposts and ship's wheel in the lobby should still be rising out of the sand like a cake decoration. My brother and I should still be pretending we don't know our parents, embarrassing us as they roll the luggage cart past the front desk, loaded with our scruffy suitcases, 2 dozen loaves of Cuban bread, brown bags bulging with enough mangoes to last the entire week, our espresso pot, the pressure cooker, and a pork roast reeking garlic through the marble lobby. All because we can't afford to eat out, mijo. Not even on vacation. Only 2 hours from our home in Miami, but far enough away to be thrilled by the whiter sands on the west coast of Florida, where I should still be for the first time watching the sun set instead of rise over the ocean. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My mother should still be in the kitchenette of the Gulf Motel, her daisy sandals from Kmart squeaking across the linoleum, still gorgeous in her teal swimsuit and amber earrings, stirring a pot of arroz con pollo, adding sprinkles of onion powder and dollops of tomato sauce. My father should still be in a terrycloth jacket, smoking, clinking a glass of amber whiskey in the sunset at the Gulf Motel, watching us dive into the pool, two sons he'll never see grow into men who will be proud of him. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My brother and I should still be playing Parcheesi. My father should still be alive, slow dancing with my mother on the sliding glass balcony of the Gulf Motel. No music, only the waves keeping time. A song only their minds hear 10,000 nights back to their life in Cuba. My mother's face should still be resting against his bare chest, like the moon resting on the sea. And the stars should still be turning around them. There should be nothing here I don't remember. My brother should still be 13, sneaking rum in the bathroom and sculpting naked women from sand. And I should still be 8 years old, dazzled by seashells and how many seconds I can hold my breath underwater. But I'm not. I'm 38, driving up Collier Boulevard, looking for the Gulf Motel. For everything that should still be, but isn't. I want to blame the condos, their shadows for ruining the beach and my past. I want to chase the snowbirds away with their tacky McMansions and yachts. I want to turn the golf courses back into mangroves. I want to find the Gulf Motel, exactly as it was, and pretend. Pretend, for just a moment, that nothing I've lost is lost.
Thank you, Richard.
That's really good.
Richard Blanco, Looking for the Gulf Motel. Is that poem from a collection?
By the same title, yeah, Looking for the Gulf Motel. Okay. That inspiration started the whole collection, actually.
Is that collection from your travels, from your journeys, as you were, sort of retracing your roots?
No.
Is that early in life?
The first book... half the book, I call it BC and AC, before Cuba and after Cuba, does chronicle my very first trip to Cuba. And then books since then, I always include poems. I've gone back to Cuba several times now, and I always learn something new or something different that becomes the subject of a poem. So there's poems about Cuba in this third book, as there is in every book. But this book was the third book of poetry was a little different in that it actually opened up a conversation about my sexuality and gender identity and male-female roles and machismo and all that stuff, which I really hadn't come out in my poetry, oddly enough, only, I think, because I hadn't found quite the right story to tell. So that's different about the third book. And then as there's also the death section, because what poetry book can do without a death section, but also watching the older generation sort of, saying goodbye to them and facing my own mortality, which in some ways that's what the Gulf Motel is also about, realizing the passage of time. It's not just nostalgia, but really the sense of the limited agency that we have as humans and the fact that we are sort of blips on a screen in some ways, time and things change and go on without us, not to depress anybody. But
No, you're touching on things that everybody thinks about, deals with.
Everybody seems to have their own Gulf Motel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's what I was thinking about as you read that.
Yeah.
The Prince of Los Cocuyos is your memoir. Now, this is a book of prose.
Yeah.
How is it for you writing prose versus poetry, especially with regard to your family and your family's story?
Oh, there's several layers to that. One, you should know that I started writing that a couple years before the inauguration, and I'm not that much of a Superman. I haven't written three books in the last year and a half. I wrote it because there were things in the poetry that there's a lot of backstory that the poems couldn't hold, and they don't need to hold. The poems work on a sort of another level, a different kind of magic, if you will. So I wanted to unpack all those stories and the way to do it, the way to really round out the character of my grandmother and my mother and my brother and all this was through prose. And I was having such fun with it that I just kept on doing it, thinking maybe someday I'll publish it, maybe not. But I was also just following my creative curiosities, and I was just curious to see what can prose do, what does my life look like and my family look like without line breaks? And what I discovered was this, you know, the ability to storytell is so much more open in prose. One interesting thing that happened was that my grandmother in the poetry is a much more vicious, much more she's still homophobic in the memoir, but the light she's casting is a lot darker in the poetry. And my mother in the poetry is more of this angelic sort of like martyr figure. You know, she left Cuba and all this stuff. In the prose, their roles, their characters switched on me because...
Your abuela.
My abuela.
Your grandmother became your abuelita.
Abuelita.
Your little grandmother, right? Yeah. She's a charming little...
She's a charmer.
And like, saves you a few times.
She's my buddy. I mean, she's totally homophobic and there's still very dark moments.
Right.
But the truth is that my... You know, with prose, you got to deal with the exterior character, right? The exterior character, and then drill into the interior character. And so, in the prose, my grandmother was—I mean, she was a bookie. You know, she was the life of the party. She always had like a gossip to tell and a joke to tell, and she'd always manage to forget her purse when we were going out to dinner. So, like, she's always as a character. So, she ends up being very likable. And my mother, on the other hand, becomes this control freak in the prose. The warden of the house, the one that runs everything. And I realized writing in the prose that was a psychological response she had to all that loss in her life, right? So what do we do when we feel our lives in shaky ground, right? She had no support system emotionally from her own sort of blood, flesh and blood. And then she went and had two boys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it was a psychological response to just hold the ship steady. So she couldn't bear to lose one more thing in her life. Not even a nail file, you know, and so that, you know, inside she was dying, but it was sort of, and so I had to, in the prose, I had to find more empathy with my mother and learn how to hate my grandmother a little bit more and make her look a little bit worse because she was coming across too nice.
She's pretty funny.
Oh, she is.
Also, your abuelita.
I still laugh. You know,
she knew she knew some guys who were sort of hooked up, right? Connected. What do you call them? Gangsters, maybe. Should I call them that? Maybe not. Maybe that's impolite.
No. I mean, in Miami, as I think still exists today, there's this, well, no, because ever since they started the official lottery, but
yeah,
it wasn't quite mafia, but it was mafioso-like. You know, there was like an illegal sort of numbers, little betting pool ring kind of stuff.
Right.
There's no,
gangster,
not that I know
gangster's
of. I don't
a little
know.
Heavy. Gangster's a little heavy.
Yeah, I don't know if my grandmother put out a hit on anybody, or not, though I wouldn't put it past her. But
the instinct to write, to be creative, to actually try your hand at poetry, when did that happen?
It happened... I think I was always a left brain, right brain kid, as I try to detail a little bit in the memoir, and that's part of, you know, the shaping of identity in terms of artistic identity and all the rest. But I kind of loved everything and was an AB student and everything, but there were several factors that squelched that. One was my grandmother, because she was very homophobic. So, you know, I used to have to hide my coloring and my, you know, painting and things. But there was also a socioeconomic...
Easy bake oven. You like the easy bake oven.
I would just love to play with my cousin Marlene, but as soon as she would come, I'd hide everything, you know, like especially when I was not playing the husband and playing house. And then there was another sort of socioeconomic factor, right? So we weren't talking about Picasso or, you know, Robert Frost at the dinner table. It was the business was survival. And then there's another factor, which was a cultural factor. So even if we were a sort of very cultured family, we were going to be talking about Wilfredo Lam and perhaps Manuel, the guitarist here, or Cuban artist, not American artist.
Right.
So
right.
My parents didn't know who the hell the Rolling Stones were, for God's sake.
Right.
Can you fathom that?
Right.
Like, it's just really odd.
They didn't watch Brady Bunch reruns with you?
They had no. And then Miami just added to that sort of bubble, that sort of insular society that you know, there was no reason to learn any of that in some ways.
And make a reference to Brady Bunch because you actually spent time watching reruns.
A lot. That's how I contextualize America. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I kind of put that aside, studied engineering again because I was good at math. I loved math. It wasn't like they forced me. But it wasn't until after to like age 24 when I really started thinking about writing. And it was because of engineering. When I got to my engineering office, you know, 65% of my job was writing. Something that's a big issue right now. I spent three days in Georgia Tech with engineers about this.
Yeah. About writing.
Yeah.
About describing projects or whatever. You went to Florida International,
Yeah, for both.
And you became a civil engineer.
Yeah.
But you spent a lot of time writing.
No, not till
24.
Yeah.
But that's what I mean. So why? Because you had to write proposals? Describe projects?
Proposals, studies, letters. Permitting conversations. You know, a permitting letter can be 8 pages long. You know, you submit your plans,
you fill out
a permit.
Were you good at clearly stating an objective or describing a project? Is that what you were good at?
And the idea of audience and tone. So, you know, you're in a proposal. Our firm has been around for over 10 years. It's been 10 years and one day, but who's counting, you know? Persuasion, exaggeration. You want to get that job, right? And how does the firm survive? They have to get the jobs, and the jobs aren't asking you to solve calculus problems. You have to put everything in language and pictures and show...
That people understand.
Create a sense of... If you're writing a permitting letter, you know, you submit your plans, a permit reviewer looks at it, they don't send you the plans back. They send you a letter explaining what's wrong with your design or what's not within code. And that's another kind of letter. That's the kind of letter. So it was wonderful to speak with you this afternoon or yesterday afternoon or last week. I'm very excited about blah, blah, blah. How are the kids? You know, blah, blah, blah. However,
You found that your writing was effective, that people noticed it?
Yeah, and okay. I started excelling in my job because of writing. And I started falling in love with language and realizing that language was engineered. That language was this beautiful, malleable thing that it all depended, that there wasn't one right way to write a sentence. There were many ways to write a sentence depending. I saw finally language as an art. And then my right brain kicked in and said, hey, weren't we going to do something at some point creative? And so I said, well, let's try. So I picked the weirdest thing I could. I was like, let's do poetry.
Wow.
And I like the idea of being a poet engineer.
Do you remember actually picking up a pad and a pen or a pencil and actually saying, all right, today I'm going to write a poem?
Yeah, there was one that's probably gone by now. I did have a couple experiences in high school, and one of them is significant with the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock. So there are little moments in my life, but certainly...
But that's not writing.
Right. That was just enjoying poetry.
The first moment you actually said, today I'm going to write a poem.
It's funny you asked that question. Nobody's ever asked me that question. But there was one moment in particular that I remember... I would go to the office in the morning. I was still living with my mom. I lived with my mom till I was 28, like a good Cuban mama's boy. And every morning there's a spider web, right, that would come from the hedge to my car door. And I'd go through the spider, you know, and the next morning there was the spider web again. And I wrote this poem called Foolish Arachnid, and it was all about sort of, it was not that great of a poem, but it was all, and of course it rhymed and the whole nine yards,
right.
But it was all about sort of this perseverance and this foolishness of the spider. His nose, I'm going to like...
Open the car door and
destroy his thing again, but it was, there were layers to it that I didn't even know. And then I started writing a few, and then I would print them up and paste them into like a hardcover blank page book to look like I had like my little book of poetry. I wrote some horrible poems, but
Did you share them with anyone?
I did start sharing with them. I was never shy about them because I had no expectations about it. I mean, I wasn't. It's really something odd about life, right? As a general rule, it's when you apply too many expectations or fear to things that I shoved my poems on everybody. I mean, I just was like, hey, what do you think about this? And some were polite. Some were okay, but they always found a little something. They said, yeah, you know, it's not bad. You should think about keep on doing this. So,
and you ended up as the poet inaugural.
Yeah.
January 21st, 2013.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to ask you, would you mind if we listen to one today?
Sure, I'd love to.
As you delivered it on that date? All right. So this is what we'll do on midday here. Dan Rodericks with Richard Blanco. We'll take another break here on midday. And when we come back, we'll listen to one today as we did on January 21st, 2013, President Obama's second inauguration, and then we'll talk some more.
One today. One sun rose on us today, kindled over our shores, peeking over the Smokies, greeting the faces of the Great Lakes, spreading a simple truth across the Great Plains, then charging across the Rockies. One light, waking up rooftops, under each one a story, told by our silent gestures moving across windows. My face, your face, millions of faces in morning's mirrors, each one yawning to life, crescendoing into our day. The penciled yellow school buses, the rhythm of traffic lights, fruit stands, apples, limes, and oranges arrayed like rainbows, begging our praise. Silver trucks heavy with oil or paper, bricks or milk, teeming over highways alongside us on our way to clean tables, read ledgers, or save lives, to teach geometry or ring up groceries, as my mother did for 20 years, so I could write this poem for all of us today. All of us, as vital as the one light we move through, the same light on blackboards with lessons for the day, equations to solve, history to question, or atoms imagined, the I have a dream we all keep dreaming, or the impossible vocabulary of sorrow that won't explain the empty desks of 20 children marked absent today and forever. Many prayers, but one light, breathing color into stained glass windows, life into the faces of bronze statues, warmth onto the steps of our museums and park benches as mothers watch children slide into the day. One ground, our ground, rooting us to every stalk of corn, every head of wheat sown by sweat and hands, hands gleaning coal or planting windmills in deserts and hilltops that keep us warm, hands digging trenches, routing pipes and cables, hands as worn as my father's, cutting sugarcane so my brother and I could have books and shoes. The dust of farms and deserts, cities and plains, mingled by one wind, our breath. Breathe. Hear it through the day's gorgeous din of honking cabs, buses launching down avenues, the symphony of footsteps, guitars, and screeching subways, the unexpected songbird on your clothesline. Hear squeaky playground swings, trains whistling or whispers across cafe tables. Hear the doors we open each day for each other, saying, hello, shalom, buongiorno, howdy, namaste, or buenos dias, in the language my mother taught me, in every language, spoken into one wind, carrying our lives without prejudice, as these words break from my lips. One sky. Since the Appalachians and Sierras claimed their majesty, and the Mississippi and Colorado worked their way to the sea. Thank the work of our hands, weaving steel into bridges, finishing one more report for the boss on time, stitching another wound or uniform, the first brushstroke on a portrait, or the last floor on the Freedom Tower, jutting into the sky that yields to our resilience. One sky toward which we sometimes lift our eyes, tired from work, some days guessing at the weather of our lives, some days giving thanks for a love that loves you back, sometimes praising a mother who knew how to give, or forgiving a father who couldn't give what you wanted. We head home through the gloss of rain or weight of snow or the plum blush of dusk, but always, always home, always under one sky, our sky, and always one moon, like a silent drum tapping on every rooftop and every window of one country, all of us facing the stars. Hope, a new constellation, waiting for us to map it, waiting for us to name it together.
One today, Richard Blanco, January 21st, 2013, at the President Obama's inauguration. Wow. How did you feel listening to that?
You takes me right back to that moment.
This was not a poem you had already written. This is a poem you wrote for the occasion, correct?
I had to write. They asked me to write three, actually.
It seems like, and then they picked one?
Mm-hmm.
They picked the one you wanted them to pick?
Not at first, but then later that turned into my favorite poem.
I mean, it's such a big assignment, right? There's the pressure to say so much and to be so good and all of that. How did you do that? That would be daunting for
it's on the one hand, I'm glad they also didn't give me 6 months, because then God knows what had happened, but we probably chickened out. But writing a poem is not just a creative endeavor; it's an emotional endeavor, right? And I always take it in that direction. When a poem is not happening, it's because there's something that you're not emotionally plugged into. And you can write, you keep on writing to work around it, but it's still that aha moment. So with One Today in particular, there are several challenges. One, that were even exaggerated in me, because my work tends to be a lot more autobiographical, but suddenly I have to write this poem that has to, pull back from that autobiography a little bit to be able to leave people in, let people into the poem. And the other bigger question was, as in much of my poetry and as much in the memoir, as I grew up just thinking, am I American? What is America? I wasn't exactly 100% convinced that my story or that I was part of America, within quotes, or the United States, within quotes. So it was kind of, can I write this poem? Honestly, I mean, it was more than just, can I write this poem in terms of craft, but where's my connection emotionally to be able to, you can't fake, honesty in a poem. And, as I wrote through it, and now that I read it and have read it and have had time with the poem, I realized that in some ways it's still that same little boy who wants to be home. And in this sense, it's home, meaning in this context of sort of this American ideal of we all have a place at the table. And I say ideal because the poem really ends with waiting for us to map that hope, waiting for us to make that true, to make good on those ideals. And I realized that in some ways it was an incredibly personal poem, because in some ways my wish for that poem was for everyone to sort of acknowledge or sit around the table for 7 minutes that the poem took. What I never realized until after reading the poem and after experiencing everything was that I wanted to be one of those people at that table. So I was writing that poem as much talking to myself as I was talking to everyone else. And isn't that what poetry really is, or any art? It's this dialogue with you and with the entire world at the same time. And that was that challenge. And that's why the reference to Sandy Hook is in there. It was a big turning point. While I was writing the poem, these questions of God, can I speak honestly to my sense of what is of my sense or love or lack of love or whatever my connection or to America, psychologically. And when that happened, it, as we all felt, you know, that moment of we just wanted to all just go there and
what
hug
was the
these
timing
parents.
Of that? Was that was December 2012?
Yeah,
I mean, there was the month before.
While you were writing the poem, the three-peat period.
Just had to remember
poems.
The date.
Yeah, it was right. A couple of days, I think, after I started writing, but suddenly I felt like, as families do, we always come together in moments of great joy and tragedy, right? Weddings and funerals, and to see the president at the memorial, and to see that memorial in three traditions of faith, and to see everybody coming together in a sense, made me feel like part of that family. Yeah, we bicker and we gossip and we can't get along and sometimes, but at the end of the day, the whole country sort of had to stop and say, this is who we are. And it, race, class, you know, culture didn't matter at that moment anymore. Yeah.
I noticed from watching the video of your reading the poem, the cutaways of people in the audience, including the president, senators, Supreme Court justices, other people I didn't recognize. A lot of people were sort of in a meditative state, eyes closed, nobody yawning, that's for sure. I mean, it was very arresting. It was very good. That's why it was a pleasure to have you on our show today, Richard.
No, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that poem. So I just wanted to go over this. There's a collection, Looking for the Gulf Motel, that you referenced.
Yeah.
That's one collection.
That's the latest, yeah.
That's the latest. The early one was City of 100 Fires. That goes back to the late
90s. That's the very first
90s.
Book of poetry.
Yeah, right. And then Directions to the Beach of the Dead, which came, that's the one I was referring to, that you had traveled to Spain and Italy. And,
yeah, that's the middle child, yeah.
Yeah.
The three.
And then, as I mentioned, Looking for the Gulf Motel. And then you wrote a piece, a prose piece, about giving the inaugural address.
Yeah, it's 2013. It's what we loosely call the inaugural memoir or the memoirette. But it's more like, it's not memoir the way we take that word today, but it's more like an account from the moment I get the phone call to the moment through writing of the poems, all the sort of creative turmoil and ecstasy. And then just, it ends with me driving back to my home in Maine and having gone that whole arc of experience and that whole transformation.
Miami to Maine.
Yeah.
By the way, Los Cocoyos, that's, refers to the fireflies,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And was a name taken from a bodega that an uncle ran, right?
Yeah, yeah. My granduncle had a small grocery store, which is where I learned to be Cuban, and I started working there since I was 12, and it became my village, so to speak. And it's Cocuyito, which is the little firefly.
Little firefly. That's what they called you?
No, the store was named
the store was
firefly.
Called that. Okay. This is, again, The Prince of Los Cocoyos, a Miami Childhood by Richard Blanco. It was a pleasure to have you on the show. If you want to meet Richard Blanco and get a copy of his book, he'll be at the Central Library tonight in the Wheeler Auditorium. That is the Enoch Pratt Free Library. Have you been to our library?
No, I've not.
It's a beauty. It's really a beauty. And so Richard will be down there in the Wheeler Auditorium at 7 p.m. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you.
It was wonderful, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. Again, if you want to meet Richard Blanco with his new memoir, he's in the Wheeler Auditorium. There's information about it on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. Before you go to the library, if you want to order a copy of the book, there's availability for doing that. You can buy a ticket online, too. So thank you, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to our midday for today. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The associate producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Our interns are Connor Graham and Marjorie Goodman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WIPR.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.